Get ready for Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Listen in as Doug and Amy provide helpful tips on how to get ready for anything that comes your way. And now, your hosts, Doug and Amy.
Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. We're here in studio today. We're going to talk a little bit about how to get the conversation flowing about prepping. I mean, that's something that we've been doing here for all these months as we're talking about prepping. We're talking about emergency preparedness. We're talking about ways that you can be better prepared in your daily life and overall, you know, certain products that you can bring into your home, certain ideas and education that you can receive and implement. But all of these are really personal decisions. And what we've been talking about up to this point is personally how to better yourself, how to create a more full person to go out and do more things for yourself without being dependent on the government or dependent on a neighbor or dependent on the rest of your family. But the larger conversation of this has to inevitably flow to no man is an island. And one of my favorite quotes, I believe it was Aristotle that said that the only people who can live by themselves, the only people who can be without the polis, are those who are either gods or animals. And I think that most of us do not fall into either of those categories. And so we need other people to be able to keep things flowing and keep things going and to achieve the most that we can. It's kind of an Adam Smith idea of economics, where you're talking about the way that you are able to best reach your maximum potential is to have specialization, and that certain people or certain, in his case, countries focus on what they're best at, and then through trade and barter and community are able to bring forth a larger goal between all of their participation. And this is the same with prepping. I mean, you may be able to grow the best garden on earth, but you may faint at the sight of blood. And how do you overcome these inadequacies that we have individually? You cannot be everything. None of us are a Superman able to take on every single task. So that means that we have to bring other people into our collective group. And the first place that we start is in our home. I like to make biblical references, and there's a story about Sodom and Gomorrah. When the Lord was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, he went to Abraham and told him, your nephew Lot is in the town. Why don't you tell him to go get out? And Abraham says, well, Lord, what if there were only 50 good people? Would you destroy the town? And he said, well, no, not for 50 people. I would save it for 50 people. And then Abraham starts thinking, he's like, well, what if there were 40 people? Then 30 people, then 20 people. Finally, he gets the Lord down to 10 people. At this point, Abraham is thinking, okay, there's Lot, his wife, her daughters, their servants. Yeah, in that one household, we've got 10 people, we're good. So the question becomes, what about your household? Is everybody on board with prepping? Are they all gung-ho about this? And if not, how do we open up that conversation, Amy?
Yeah, you are spot on when we talk about we need a community. And one of the things I have found is that a lot of people who are into emergency preparedness, they really keep it secret. They keep it to themselves.
OPSEC.
Exactly. They don't advertise it. They don't talk openly about it on social media. And I think there's two main reasons. One is when things go bad, they don't want people flooding their house and taking their stuff. Mm-hmm. And another one is they don't want to look like lunatics or seem crazy.
There's two avenues there about flooding the house and taking the stuff. On the one hand, if everybody in the world knows that you have, you know, $1 million worth of gold in your basement and no security, you're ripe for burglary. On the other hand, even if you keep it just within your friends and family, the old joke goes, well, you have all the stuff. I know where I'm going in an emergency.
Oh, exactly.
So
yeah.
Am I supposed to, you know, it's kind of the chicken, you know, baking the bread and
Little Red Hen.
Little Red Hen, yes.
Right.
We go back to that story and I'm going to do all the work and you're going to get all the benefit. I don't think so.
Right.
But there is a point where I don't think so gives way. When it's your wife or your grown children, maybe, yeah, you do say, well, shoot, I'll bite the bullet and buy a little extra because I know they're going to come here and I know they aren't getting ready. But the question is, why aren't they getting ready?
Exactly. And I'm the type, Doug, that I have a bleeding heart. And the people that I know and love, if they come to my house, I'm going to open the doors and I'm going to let them in. I'm going to take care of them. You know, I'm the protective mama bear of the family. But here's the thing. The food that I'm putting away, just focusing on food only, there's so many different aspects of preparedness. But if you just look at food, the amount that I have stored will sustain just my immediate family, my husband, my kids, for a certain amount of time. If I bring in, you know, my parents, my brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews,
and
all of a sudden, and my, what? No, you'll be fine. But so you know, all of a sudden that period of time that I'm prepared for shrinks down significantly.
Yeah, you don't really, I mean, it's logical, but you don't really think about it. People come and say, you know, I'm going to buy a year's supply of food. Well, for how many people?
Right.
Well, for me. Okay. Well, the year's supply of food for me gives, has 6 months supply for two people, a 3 month supply. Yeah. And then it just keeps, you know.
It does. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Yeah. Yeah. And you're not going to, you know, unless you are just absolutely heartless, you're not going to turn people away. And we go back to the fact that we need each other. So it looks at, you know, when we look at the duration that we are preparing for, if it's just maybe a month, or if we really think something bad's going to happen and we're preparing for a year or 2 years, we have to bring those into account. So then we kind of go back and circle around to what, how do we bring the people on board? So, you know, for example, my brother has really started to have his eyes open, and I went over and brought some Mylar bags and showed him how to put, you know, rice away and things like that. And he's starting to get it and understand it. I'm like, okay, good. So if he's on board and he starts putting the food away, now I need to get, you know, this person that I love on board. But how do we...
Well, this may be a perfect time to bring this up amongst people in your close family units because the economy is not getting better. I mean, you keep hearing things, oh, things are getting better. Oh,
well,
things
are
getting
better. Well, it depends on what news broadcast you're listening to,
but
I think.
But the problem is it's really not. If you look at what your buying power is now versus 7 years ago versus 14 years ago, it's dramatic. I mean, people are making a lot less money. You may have the same salary, but you are actually, because of your buying power, you're earning a lot less. And people are noticing it. I heard a report just this week that for the first time in history, the average American saves $0 a year. There is no extra money being put away at all.
Yeah.
Now, it used to be that, you know, you had spenders and savers, and in years past, the average was around $500 to $1,500 saved a year, every year put away. But now, it's zero. The average across the board is zero.
Yeah.
And so people are realizing that they don't have anything to put away. They don't have a nest egg anymore. They don't have a security fund. You know, all the Dave Ramsey logic, let's put away some money and spend less. How can I spend less? We're already eating cornflakes and corn dogs, right. You know, for three meals a day. How do you spend less than that?
Right. And it's hard if you're not able to have that little bit of extra money to put aside, you know, as cash. You know, sometimes it's difficult to, you know, I kind of look at food as sort of an insurance policy.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's kind of hard to even do that at times.
Well, the easiest way to get started is to find your 2-for-1 sales at Publix, because then you're spending the same amount of money you normally do, but you're getting twice the food and you can put half of it away. If you just work those kind of deals across the board for a year, faithfully finding those deals and putting them away, you can store up 2 months worth of food without even spending an extra dime.
Right. Yeah. And there's a lot of people who do coupons too. It's a great way to do it.
Couponing, not the extreme couponing, just normal couponing will bring in just enough so that you are actually putting a little away. And you don't, I mean, if you save 30 cents on a bag of chips, you're not going to really notice it. But if you do that in conjunction with expanding your preps to be able to have more pasta in the pantry and more this and more that, by the end of the year, you look at your pantry and you realize that you have quite a bit of food there. And this is, you know, one of those things that's going to gradually bring your family into alignment with the thinking that you have to have more than what you barely need. Because when, you know, there's an emergency and you say, well, shoot, you know, we have to put new tires on the car and it's going to be $400. And well, you know, we normally spend $400 in 2 weeks on food, but we can't now. So let's just raid the pantry for 2 weeks and we'll make it and come through. And then suddenly everyone realizes, wow, it's a really good idea to have this stuff stored up. And then that can gradually expand into other areas, including water purification, first aid, and other things that are needed more for an emergency.
Yeah. Some people, Doug, too, I think that, you know, even though they're introduced to the idea of emergency preparedness, they shut it down. And a lot of people out there just kind of have that feeling, it's not the whole, it's not going to happen to me mentality. You know, just like anything else in the world, like, you know, coming up with cancer or diabetes or, you know, having a loved one to pass away or things like this. We know this stuff happens every single day. You know, hurricanes happen all the time. You know, natural disasters happen all the time. Things happen. But there's just a part of us that just doesn't want to go there.
You have to have, in some respects, cancer, diabetes, you know, the tragic loss of a loved one, short. You have to have a willing suspension of disbelief that you have to, in order to stay sane, you have to realize that,
true.
you have to have this barrier because there's nothing you can do about it. There's, you know, if you are diagnosed with diabetes, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. You can't take it away.
Yeah.
You know, if you have cancer, you can't prepare to make sure that if you had cancer that you would be better off. You know, there's nothing you can do. But for things like an economic collapse, loss of electricity, a plague, or a major storm, there are steps you can take to put yourself in a really good position if that were to happen. I know we're coming up on a commercial break, folks. Stay tuned. We're going to talk more about how to get your family involved in prepping and what prepping really means when we come back in just a minute. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the Talk of the Town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back. Today, we're talking about some great stuff. We need to talk to our families. We need to open up about emergency preparedness.
Get our families involved and have a group, you know, being larger than just two people. That's the end goal, is that you have people who are really going to support you and help you and get you through everything that's coming up and carry the load with you.
Well put, Doug. Yes. And, you know, we already talked about earlier in our first segment, there are people that I mean, maybe some of you out there are heartless. Maybe you can turn away your mother because, you know, maybe I don't know, you know, shame on you. But I can't do it. And here's the thing. I don't want to try to put away a year's worth of food for all those people that I love. I come from a big family.
Yeah. I mean, you'd end up being like the Hosea mission at the end of the day, trying to feed the whole city of Atlanta.
I know. I would do it. And here's the thing, too. Where do you draw that line? But I mean, we'll talk about sort of larger groups in a minute. But right now, let's focus in on our immediate family and our very close friends.
Well, that's a group that you can define easily without having to get into those kind of splitting of hairs and angels on heads of pins discussion, because your family is the people who live in your house. And let's start there.
Yes.
All of them need to be contributing and working towards the same goal. But often that doesn't work. I mean, even on simple projects like keeping a family budget, that doesn't often work, much less larger 5-year campaigns to become fully prepared.
Yeah, and you know, it is so often that even when it comes to emergency preparedness, that one spouse will be on board and the other one won't, and it causes strife in the marriage. You know,
well, that's the way it is with everything. If you have two savers in a marriage, you're very blessed because you'll have a lot of money saved up and you'll live frugally and you won't complain too much about anything.
Right.
If you have two spenders in a marriage, then you're ended up in bankruptcy and probably divorce because it just can't work.
Right. You can play the blame game back and forth.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So in the end, most of the marriages that are functional end up with one saver and one spender, because you've got somebody who's making sure that the bills get paid and somebody who's keeping things fun and moving and having something to show for it at the end of the day. But that's also kind of the problem we run into in prepping, because you have a prepper who's a saver and you have a spender who doesn't see the need for it, and they don't have the, well, this is a budget, we have to have bills, we have to get paid argument to fall back on to cut off what needs to be done for prepping like you would have for what needs to be done for saving.
Yeah, and there's, you know, certain things that, you know, since I'm in the middle of this, and it's kind of reversed, which is sort of odd. A lot of times the male is the prepper, which I have found. I am seeing a little bit of a switch over here lately, but a lot of times, you know, I found that the woman in the household really hasn't been on board. You know, I'm not really sure why.
That's really strange to me. I'm not discounting your experience, but my experience has been totally different. It's the men who want to be able to spend to the maximum. They want a new car. They want.
This is different. I'm talking about emergency preparedness.
I know.
Now, when you go back to like sort of the saver spender, it's reverse in my family, where my husband's the free spirit, I think is how Dave Ramsey puts it, and I'm the one that kind of tries to hold things together.
Right. But when it comes to prepping, the traditional role of the woman to be the canner, the preserver, the one who manages the home economics would tend to be more towards the prepping mindset.
You would think.
Than the husband. And because the traditional role of the husband as the breadwinner, the farmer, the person who's out and doing, they see themselves as, well, I can always make more money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could always work an extra shift, or I could always plant an extra couple acres, or I could always do something else to bring in more.
Right.
I could go kill a deer. Right. We'd have what we need. It doesn't really matter. Let's do what we want now. And if we have needs, we'll meet the needs when they come. So, you know, the hunter aspect is much more free-spirited than the farming gatherer homesteading aspect that I think is more of a woman's mindset overall. Women crave security.
They do. Absolutely.
And so that brings in, well, I need to have stuff put away and mm-hmm. stored up and ready to go. Mm-hmm. And but I know that you have a great experience talking with people and dealing with people about prepping issues. Your take on it is that those roles are being reversed.
We are seeing a switch, though.
And
I mean,
what I'm thinking is, does that mean that there's some kind of broader societal change in the way that men and women's roles are being evaluated in light of this? Because if the traditional roles of, you know, the husband and the wife being, and, you know, this plays out in lots of different aspects, but I'm just using husband and wife as an example. But if the traditional roles are that the wife is the home economist, making sure that you have preserves, making sure that you don't waste food, making sure that you put up what you have, and the husband is, I can always go get more, and we start to see this shift, what does that say about society in a broader perspective? I mean, is it that our gender roles are becoming less defined? Is this a byproduct of that the men are starting to become more security conscious?
Yeah, I think when you pull in that majority of households have dual income, it really does kind of even out the playing fields. And that fine line of where roles lie, you know, they start to get muddled. And I think you're right. I mean, if you look at how things were 100 years ago, they are not the same now. And, you know, a lot of times we are on the same playing field.
I think that that's an interesting point, because and my gut reaction when you say that would be to say much to our chagrin, because I think that life was a better life 100 years ago.
We speculate.
In a lot of ways.
Right.
But then, you know, you start to think about it logically, and there are huge advances that we are having socially now, which are positive advances, where people are more tolerant, more considerate, more forgiving, more accepting, and that's a wonderful thing to do. But the problem that I see is that we are reaching this tolerance by sacrificing some of the things that make us great.
Or family.
Or family, yeah.
Yeah, like raising our kids.
Right.
we send them off to daycare, and, you know, we have strangers raise them, you know, in school, and they go to daycare, and basically they're home to sleep, mm-hmm. and we're not a family unit, you know, other than on the weekends.
We don't cook our own food. Mm-hmm. We don't raise our own mm-hmm. kids. We don't provide our own entertainment.
No.
We're constantly looking for the maximization of everything. We fill our cog roll, and then we go to someone else to do the cooking because mm-hmm. that's their cog roll, and we go to someone else to do the raising because that's their cog roll.
Or to come into our house and clean our house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And all of these aspects kind of have a bleed over into our discussion today, because that's the idea behind the large group that we're working towards. When we get into the next segment, we're talking about, you know, how do you get to create a larger group? What we're talking about is a microcosm society. If there was a huge breakdown, how do you create that microcosm society where people are doing, you know, instead of one person having to do everything, you have every person having a job, and it creates a greater whole than any one person could, or any 12 people working on their own could create by having them work together. But we have taken that to an extreme in our current society, so much so that nobody is really filling all of their roles as a human being. Instead, now they are just part of a vast machine where we get all of our consecutive needs met by other people who are devoted to that single task, like making fast food.
Right. And when we kind of go back and look at sort of our smaller groups, going back to the women, and we do say that, or at least I see that women are starting to become more aware of, oh my gosh, all it takes is a little bit to jump on Pinterest. It's awesome. I love Pinterest. But you see a lot of, a lot of the women are jumping on board with this now. And here's the thing too. We go back to talk about how to open up conversation with our families and our immediate family and friends. I actually for Christmas, gave away prepper type items for gifts, and we did like sort of the white elephant gift and things like that, and I brought a lot of those items in.
See, for Christmas I asked all my friends to go to True Prep and buy me something. That got them into the store and talking to their salespeople and
yes.
get them involved in the process, and of course they're going in there wide eye going, I have no idea what he wants, and I think he already has everything, and still they came back with great gifts.
I know that True Prep offered some really cool Christmas little combinations and things like that for the beginning prepper.
Looking at the family family. And that's where we need to start, is we need to start with the family and getting people on board. And all of these ideas about, you know, how to get other people who aren't really in your immediate family interested and involved are great. But unless they can look at your the best testimony you can provide about being a prepared person is for your close friends to look at your family and see that your family is becoming prepared. Not just you, but you as a whole. And that comes back to, like, last week's show where we talked about vacations, using a vacation as a chance to prepare, using everything that you do as a chance to bring your family together around some certain core ideas of being ready for emergencies, being ready for a disaster, and being ready for even a loss of a job or something that happens that's mundane but catastrophic.
Yeah, Doug, there's actually some great movies and books and podcasts and radio shows and things along those lines, too, that when you are in the preparedness mindset, you know, a lot of times you kind of dig in and delve into that kind of stuff. I think a great way to share this is by sharing that type of information with our family and friends who might not be on board. Here's an example. I read One Second After, great book. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I wanted my husband to read it. Now, here's two problems. One, he travels all the time. He doesn't have a whole lot of spare time. Number two, he's dyslexic. He doesn't like to read.
Audiobook.
There you go. That's what I did. You're a mind reader. So I got the audiobook for him, and in his travels, you know, sometimes he's on the plane, sometimes he's in the car. So when he was in the car, listened to the book, and he was like, wow, you know, that really does bring, and we were able to discuss the book back and forth. Mm-hmm. Well, after that, I gave the audiobook to my brother. And I said, you know, this is a great book. I just want you to, because I know he's in the car a lot too. Mm-hmm. So I gave it to him, and it kind of opened up some great, you know, discussion with him. But, you know, there's some great things out there. American Blackout, I believe, is on YouTube. I'll have to double check that and put it on a link on readyradio.net for our listeners. It was on Nat Geo. I think I've mentioned that before. It's a great movie out there called The Road.
I hated that movie.
Yeah, I know. I was about to say, I don't know if it was called it great. It was great the way that they did it, but man, it was depressing.
It was feel good movie of the summer. Let me tell you, I watched that with my wife, and we finished it, and we kind of sat there in silence for a minute as a credit rolled. And
right, you're like, you want to cut your wrist after that.
We didn't even look at each other. She just was like, "What was that?" and I didn't even look over. I just said, "I don't know, but I'm glad we rented it."
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, no spoilers, but yeah, that movie. I mean, it's
very
dark. It's a roller coaster ride of fun and excitement. Let me tell you,
and it's on Netflix. So those of you out there who have Netflix, check out The Road.
Oh,
I think Jericho is on Netflix too.
I love Jericho. Jericho is one of my favorite shows.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a quick break, Doug. We'll come back. We'll talk about Jericho. You can kind of fill people in on that, and then after that, we'll dive into talking about maybe community, a little bit of a large group. So hang on, stick with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Doug and Amy on News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Doug and Amy. We're on News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town, and today we're talking about how to get more people involved in your preparations. When we took our break, Amy was just cutting me off from talking about Jericho and what a wonderful show it was, and how it highlights some of the problems with having a larger community involved in a disaster, and some of the advantages of having community and some of the bigger aspects of having friends and family all involved in a common purpose. So, Amy, you were, during our commercial break, you were expounding on the bus scene.
Well, I was poking fun at you a little bit, Doug. I know that you really enjoyed Jericho, and I know that there's people out there who, there was something about bringing it back where so many people like wrote into the station, which I'll let you talk about in a second.
And sent peanuts,
right? Yeah. So they actually brought the show back. So, well, here's the thing. I mean, I enjoyed the idea, I enjoyed the concept, but I just didn't think it was very well written. I didn't think the acting was very good. And I was about to tell you about the bus scene. Okay. So those of you, some of you have seen it, some of you haven't, but I'm not gonna. It's not a spoiler alert. There's a part where they bring the bus back. The kids are gone.
It's been what, 7 years since it came out? 5 years? I don't think we have to worry about spoilers.
Shame on you. It's on Netflix. So there's this bus scene. So the kids are coming back, and they've been out. It's nighttime. These kids are missing. These little kids, okay? And, you know, a lot of the parents are in the town. So finally, you know, the hero drives the bus back, and there they are. And here's the kids coming home. Panic is set in. First of all, if I were a parent, there would have been screaming. There would have been, oh, my God, they're back! I mean, just whatever. I would have been on that bus finding my child. Let me tell you, that scene was calm. Everybody was standing nicely outside the bus as they're unloading a child at a time and very quietly talking. I'm like, no.
Well, that's because you're a red-haired Southern girl. If you were born in the Midwest and had blonde hair and blue eyes, and you had been standing there quietly waiting with your bowl of lutefisk to hand to this poor child as they got off. I thought it was awesome because the hero was there collecting straws from the juice boxes and tying them together with a rubber band in order to do his tracheotomy.
He would have killed her. I mean, that's... Yeah. So... But anyway,
here are some of the bigger themes of Jericho, which I thought were very interesting and applicable to the community situation. First off, you've got gouging. The people who were running the town market were gouging people like mad. Mm-hmm. Second, bartering came into play. People couldn't afford their standard, you know, salt and flour and everything else, and who knew when it was coming. So they were giving away family heirlooms to the storekeeper in order to be able to buy simple staple items. That's another huge aspect that's going to come into play in any kind of long-term emergency. But then after that, after things settled down and you got a little bit of normalcy and people were adjusting to the way things were, the town brought out generators, they put up lights, they had a party in the town square to make people feel at home and comfortable again. When the town next door started to become a threat and raiding and what's going to happen, the town pulled together and everybody went out there and defended themselves, even with a tank, which was pretty cool, even if they killed off Gerald McRaney, which was a bad, bad move. But we're talking about ways that, you know, this shows the way community really works. You know, there's times when it pulls against itself, and then there's times when it pulls together. Mm-hmm. And when it pulls against itself, it's strained and it's hard. But if it wasn't there in the times it had to pull together, none of them would have existed anymore. Yeah. They would have been completely overrun.
Yeah, and Jericho, I forget where it was set, but Kansas. I know it was set. Oh, it was in Kansas. Okay, because I know it was like sort of a little old town. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the Atlanta type. You know, I just couldn't imagine Atlanta pulling together. We're so ginormous. Well, but who knows? I mean, there could be small groups here and there that would...
I think that there are pockets of homogeneous groups of people in the city that could pull together and form a cohesive group. You can't take a million people and pull them together.
No.
I mean, even on the basis of just normal society, we don't pull together, much less in the face of adversity. But yes, a smaller town is more likely to have that. It's more likely to have both sides, where it pulls against itself and pulls together in times of need. So, I mean, I'm thinking about Joplin, Missouri, when they had the tornado go through and the outpouring of love and affection that went there to put them back on their feet. If it's a localized event, you'll see that happen in short order, too. You know, there may be the moment where, you know, everything breaks down and there's rioting and looting and martial law and who knows how bad it gets, but... If it's a localized event, in a short amount of time, there's going to be an outpouring of affection and love from surrounding communities to put people back on their feet. I mean, who hasn't given, you know, $5 for tsunami relief once in their life? And that's a half a world away, and we're pulling together for those people, too. And that's, you know, part of human nature. Humans are horrible, horrible creatures that will turn on each other and eat their own, but they are also divine creatures that have a spirit of love and giving that will pull together and help.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the mystery of what makes us who we are, is we're both good and evil at the same time, mixed together and fighting amongst ourselves, trying to figure out who we really are. And at the end of the day, I think that more people come out on the side of good, which is why I'm here trying to get something done so that people are better prepared for the future, so that they aren't swept away and that they aren't overcome by the few who are truly evil.
Right. And within every single group, you know, if you do find yourself in a group, you know, I think you're going to have that mixture within the group also. And you really have to take fairness out of the equation because, you know, there's one of the things I think that we as humans, we always want everything to be fair. And if I'm working, then he needs to be working. Or if I'm, you know, giving, you know, X amount of rice to, you know, for the greater good, then they need to give also. You know, you just have to put that aside. You just have to, you know, just go by the golden rule, just live by love. And, you know, if everybody, you know, took it, just if everything were altruistic, then I think, you know, ultimately, you know, then survival would be more reachable.
The problem is that there are truly evil people in this
there
world.
Are, yeah.
I mean, I've been a criminal defense attorney for 9 years. I was a prosecutor for 1 year. I've seen both sides of human evil, and there is evil out there. And evil does not ride in wearing Darth Vader's mask and cape. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come wearing a black hat and saying, hey, look at me, I'm evil. Mm-hmm. Evil comes as your best friend saying, you know, hey, all I want is your best, and I'm going to help take care of you, and I'm going to do the best for you, and let's all pull together on this, and let's go do things together. That's the way evil works its way into your group. And then the next thing you know, you turn around and you've lost everything. And why? Because there's somebody who valued what you had more than they valued mm-hmm. you. And they will take it.
Yes.
And how do you guard against that in a group? Well, you can't.
No, and you can't weed out these people because some of them might be your family.
They might be family. They mm-hmm. could be very close friends. Yeah. But in the end, they are people who only value themselves. So they don't mm-hmm. have that sense of conscience. They don't have an altruistic spirit. They are the embodiment, in my view, of pure evil. And so what do? When all you can do is to treat everybody fairly. And then when those people finally show themselves, you take enough precautions in the way that you deal with everybody so that no one can take away everything you have. And then at the end of the day, when they do reveal themselves, you cut them loose in whatever way or means is necessary to ensure that they are completely gone from your life. And that's good advice for today. That's good advice after the zombies come. That's good advice 2,000 years ago, is that you treat people honestly and fairly. You protect yourself. And then if they show themselves to be untrustworthy or a bad person, then you cut them out of your life.
Yeah. And I can definitely see that, too. Like, you know, Doug, we talk about sometimes different levels, you know, of emergencies. And, you know, there might be a week, you know, that you're without power or something because of a natural disaster. It could be up to a year or two, you know, from a grid failure. And I can really see, I guess, when we talk about this topic, sort of like the long term, you know, because if you're in a little small community and you have a year's worth of food and you're working on growing and you're working on your homesteading, and then you have that cancerous person, you know, that's affecting everybody within the group, these are the things you don't really think about. But you sort of have to if you really focus in on the community and how to live together in different roles that different people play. But how do you ask someone to leave?
In the end, you have to have checks and balances so that people's base nature works for the greater good instead of against it. That's one way. If everyone's looking for their own advantageous situation, then when their power is balanced against each other. I mean, the framers had this in mind when they created our system of government, that no matter what you did, individuals in the government would always be fighting for themselves, but that would keep anyone from getting too powerful. We're coming up on another commercial break, folks. You're listening to Doug and Amy on Ready Radio News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Doug and Amy on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town. When we went to our last commercial break, we were just starting to get into security and how to kind of weed out the cancerous people. And I know that Amy has some suggestions for us on what are the best ways to kind of help get people out of the group.
Big old karate chop to the neck. Pew! I don't know.
Well, you know, you can go to the Walking Dead method and kind of vote people out and send them on their merry way, drop them off in the middle of the woods.
Yeah, I will not know exactly what I would do until you know, I cross that path. It's one of those things I could speculate all day long, but to be in a certain situation, I'm just not sure.
I think that it's actually pretty simple. You go up to somebody, you talk to the other people in your group, you explain that this person is not a good person and cannot be allowed to remain. You take charge as the leader of your group, and then you go to the person who's causing the problem and say, you are not welcome here anymore. And I do not care what it takes, but you will not be back here again. And you let them leave.
Yeah. Well, I think that sounds good. But for them to actually leave, like the security of a group, it's kind of like The Walking Dead. Let's go back to that. You have zombies out there who are ready to eat your flesh, and you're just going to say, oh, okay, well, sorry things didn't work out. I'll catch you guys on the flip side. I just don't see it happening. But I can also see people within the group, you know. Now, first of all, if it's someone that is so horrendous that they're being asked to leave, I would imagine that the majority of the group would
group
be behind.
Consensus.
Yes. But very rarely is that one particular person not connected to other immediate family members. So, like, maybe it's a wife. And the husband's like, she's not leaving. If she's leaving, I'm leaving. Or the kids, or, you know, things like that. So,
At which point, as a larger group, you may have to banish an entire family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really what it comes down to. Because if you cannot make those tough calls, and you cannot weed out the people who are dangerous and depleting resources and not contributing and undermining the authority of the leader of the group, if you can't get rid of those people, you will not survive.
Yeah. That's true. Well, let's talk a little bit about security. I mean, so let's assume that we've got, you know, everything's hunky-dory and wonderful and the group's fantastic and we're not kicking anybody out, but there's bad guys out there. And, yeah, I mean, there's good people, there's bad people. Let's say that there's bad people on the outside. Let's focus
let's
this segment on security.
Let's say there's good people doing bad things because they're desperate.
Yeah, there's that too.
I mean, there's a lot of aspects to this. Just because somebody's stealing bread doesn't mean they're a bad person.
That's very true.
But if they're stealing my last loaf of bread, then they're a very bad person. I mean, there's a whole bunch of the shades of gray on the morality spectrum here become very fine indeed when you're starting to talk about survival situation and people and the movie The Road.
Mm-hmm.
I tend not to think of those situations. I see them as being relatively remote. Instead, I'm looking at you lose your job and you've got a friend who's telling your family, well, look, he really can't provide for you anymore. Why are you staying with him? Or you have a hurricane or a tornado go through your town and you have the people showing up saying, yeah, give us $5,000. We'll fix your roofs. You know, the ones who then disappear. You know, those.
Right.
There are sharks in every
Without
disaster.
A doubt, yes.
And it doesn't have to be zombies for it to be a disaster where the sharks come out. It can be something as simple as a person losing their job or a person having a personal disaster that brings out people who are trying to take advantage and take over and destroy what you've built up.
Well, and what do we do in those situations? That's kind of the key.
Well, the first step, I think, is to have group cohesion, whether it's just you and your family or you and four or five friends or four or five friends and their families or an entire town. You've got to have trust that's built in that, you know, when you turn to your town mayor, you know who he is, you talk to him, and when he says, you know, I think that we need to take this course or that course, at the end of the day, you do what he says. When you're down to, it's a family, when the head of the household, and I say head of the household because there are some families without a father, or there are some families without a mother, there are some families with, you know, a different situation. You may have a larger family, you may have, you know, two moms or whatever, it doesn't matter. But when the head of the household says, okay, I've considered everything, this is the course we have to set, everyone has to be behind him. And when we look at the intermediate group, not the town with the mayor, not a family with the head of household, but a group of, say, five families working together, there still has to be a head. There has to be someone who's leading. And when that person says, we do this, we don't do this, this is the course, everyone says, yeah, the group is worth it. We'll follow along. This is a course we take, and we're all behind it. And when someone from the outside comes in and says, you know, I don't think so-and-so knows what he's doing. You really, why are you sticking with him? You say, because they're the leader, and we trust them, and this is a course we're taking. And if you don't have that kind of trust inside your group, if you don't have that unit cohesion, you're not a group, and you will not last.
Right. You have if leadership is so important. I mean, you would have a group that would just implode and would just ruin themselves from the inside out.
And it has to be a leader who is singular in purpose. You can't have someone who's wishy-washy or gets swayed by the public opinion, because then you have no leader at all. You can't have leadership decisions divided up amongst so many people that there's never a clear direction. You have to have vision and focus and purpose and tasks and leadership, real leadership, to make something happen. And I think that that's one of the things that's kind of falling down in our country these days, is that we're no longer We don't have really a president who is leading authoritatively. We have a committee, And it's you know, there's all of this, you know, decentralized decision making. And if something goes wrong, then, oh, well, you know, I never heard about it. And this goes, I'm not picking on President Obama. This goes all the way back to Reagan with, I never heard of Iran-Contra. I never knew about what was going on in Desert Storm. I have no idea who that woman was.
Right.
You know, every time there's this blame shifting and there's enough people with fingers in the pot because everyone wants a bit of the power. So everyone reaches in. And then when it's who's got their hand in the cookie jar, everyone pulls out as fast as they can. Sure. And it snaps down on the last hand. And you go, oh, it was that one.
Right. Well, there's too many chiefs and not enough Indians.
And the buck no longer stops here. And that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And no matter what your group or organization or company is, when you have that situation, there's no clear goal. There's no clear directive. And it implodes.
Right. And, you know, people naturally, when they're born, I feel like they're born with different personalities. And there are natural leaders and there are natural followers. And mm-hmm. we need all of them in order to be self-sustaining. And it, you know, I mean, being trustworthy is it's got to be somebody within the group that's very trustworthy.
And I hate to do it twice in the same show, but another biblical example, Moses was trying to run everything by himself. And his father-in-law came to him and said, you know, you aren't making it. You got to delegate this. You need to have captains of tens and captains of hundreds and captains of thousands and let them do their jobs mm-hmm. because you cannot do everything and lead a group of millions of people. And that's God's honest truth right there. You cannot be one person and say, I'm going to do this and this and this mm-hmm. and this and this and this and this, no. and I'll do it all, because you can't. No man is Superman. Mm-hmm. You must delegate to your subordinates. You must have subordinates that you trust, that you can hand them a task, let it go, not ever think about it again, and know that it will be accomplished. It's such an important aspect of leadership to know to delegate responsibility to trustworthy people. It's another important aspect of leadership to have trustworthy people to delegate to, so that you can make sure that you don't have to micromanage, that it can just be done. And this comes with, when you're forming your group, you need to make sure that you have someone who has a vision to make things move forward. You need to have captains of tens and captains of hundreds who can look at the bigger picture and keep things on task, and people who can get down into the grunt level and say, quick, do this, do that, get that boiler working. We need this done now. And that way, when you get up to the mid-management level, they know that things are being done. They don't have to delve deeper. And the person who has a strategic vision knows that everything is being accomplished. And by having everything broken up that way, your mid-sized group or your small town is able to function without one person running around like a chicken with his head cut off, trying to keep every single plate spinning.
Yeah, that's right. And this is going to be so important, especially when it comes to security. Now, that's not my particular area of expertise. My area would be more the caregiver, or making sure that everybody's fed, you know, the kids are put to bed. But you know, when you have leadership, when you're focusing on security, this is important.
This is a key aspect of security. Okay, let's say you have three groups of three, and each one of them has one person who reports to one person above them, and that person reports up the chain to the leader or the visionary. That gives you the ability to keep close control on what's happening. If there's a security breach, if you have an interloper come in, it's taken care of at that little three-person group level, and it doesn't spread to the entire group. If you have someone who's trying to undermine, it stays centralized. If you have someone who attacks, they're not in on every single aspect of the operation. So being compartmentalized, being answerable to a single authority who has vision, but having unit directors, having individuals who are responsible for their area of expertise helps to not only expand the utility of the project, but make it more secure from attack and from undermining influences.
Right. And this can even go back to smaller situations. So maybe if it's just one home where you have, you know, your family members, anywhere from just a small family all the way up to a large community that's actually, you know, taken an entire neighborhood possibly, mm-hmm. or even, you know, if you're lucky enough to have some, you know, some land with, you know, something, you know, possibly like in North Georgia or something along those lines. But the same concept really goes along the board.
I implement these concepts in my family on a daily basis. For example, my daughter is too small to be outside by herself. My son is almost old enough to be outside by himself, but not quite. My son is tasked to always know where my daughter is outside, whether I'm standing right on top of him or I'm in the backyard or I ran in the house for a minute. It is always his job to know where my daughter is. If anything outside the ordinary happens, if they see an animal, if they saw a car coming, if they saw anything, it's his responsibility to get my daughter in the house. Now, do I expect him to be able to really do that? No, he's too little. But he still has that task. And if he doesn't do it, even though I'm standing over watching them, I hold him accountable for it, to ingrain in the idea that he is responsible for someone else's safety as well as his own. I'm responsible for everyone's safety because I am the head of my household. My wife is responsible for the children's safety, but I don't hold her accountable for mine. And I don't hold the children accountable for hers. But as you go down the line, each one has their own level of trust and their expectations. And that has to be in any group. Family, giant corporation, individual town, security group in an emergency. All of those have to have that level of trust and confidence. I think we are just about out of time, folks. This was a very great week. Be sure to check out True Prep at trueprep.com. That's T-R-U-P-R-E-P. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. The product of the week this week for True Prep is...
Yeah, they're the NanoVaults.
NanoVaults. Yes. Fantastic product. Allows you to securely store your gun or valuables in a out-of-the-way place. It bolts into place and has a quick access feature. Be sure to check them out at trueprep.com. Everyone have a great weekend. This is Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
You've been listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by True Prep. For all your prepping needs, visit True Prep online at truprep.com or visit a True Prep store in Roswell or Marietta. Tune in each week as Doug and Amy get you ready for anything that comes your way. Ready Radio, Saturday evenings at 5, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.